Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air. This week, we discuss the latest episode, The Citadel.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Republic Forces Radio Network, your source for all things Clone Wars. I'm Dan, and joining me this week is Jen.
Hello.
Barrent, Master Collect Them All, Boy Everest.
No droid will ever break me.
And from Star Wars Fanworks, Nathan P. Butler.
Hey, everybody. My droid will break Barrent.
All right. We are here to discuss The Citadel, episode 18 of season 3, production number episode 14 of season 3. Before we jump into our discussion, let's go ahead and get a brief episode summary.
Our fortune cookie this week is Adaptation is the Key to Survival. We find that Master Evan Peel has been captured on an important mission in Outer Rim space and taken to a separatist prison called the Citadel. Obi-Wan, Anakin, Master Kun, and a few clones plot a mission to infiltrate the Citadel and rescue Master Peel. After the briefing, Ahsoka catches up with Anakin to find that she is not included in this mission.
This isn't a mission for learning. You either do or die. And that's not a risk I'm willing to share.
As R2 shows off his reprogrammed battle droids to C-3PO, Echo, Fives, Rex, Cody, and a few other clones, Anakin and Obi-Wan prepare to be carbon frozen for the infiltration. Meanwhile, Ahsoka discusses her misgivings with Master Plo. Despite their unease of the idea, the clones and Jedi are carbon frozen and loaded onto the shuttle R2 and the battle droids will fly to the Citadel. After an inspection by Citadel security, the shuttle is allowed to land and everyone is unloaded and defrosted, including Ahsoka.
I must have carbon sickness because I could swear that's Ahsoka.
Your eyes are fine. It's Ahsoka's hearing that needs help.
Ahsoka says she received orders to join the team, and when questioned as to whose orders she is following, she says she had a discussion with Master Plo about the mission. Just like a teenager. After some brief chastisement, Obi-Wan welcomes Ahsoka to the team, and leaving the droids to guard the shuttle, the mission continues. After a climb up an electro-mine-riddled cliff to a door, the plan is impeded when a droid patrol locks the door that was the team's entry point. Fortunately, little Ahsoka stowed along, and she can slip through the ventilation duct and open the door. When a clone slips and detonates one of the electro-mines, the Citadel is alerted to the team's presence. And it would seem that O.C. Sobek is not one to skimp when it is time to break out security.
Activate all security protocols! Lock everything down! Where are my special units?
Moving carefully through the base to avoid patrols, eliminating surveillance and automated defenses, the team makes its way to Master Peel's cell, where he is being tortured for the information. Once freed, Evan tells the team that to make sure the intel did not fall into enemy's hands, he deleted the information from the ship's computers after he and his captain had each memorized half. So to get the intel out, they will have to spring Master Peel's captain, too. As the team makes its way to rescue the officers, they encounter the Citadel's first team of commando droids. After dispatching them, the team runs into a trap involving magnetic ceilings and commando droids with magnetized feet. After escaping the trap, the team makes its way to the officer's cell, where they find Evan's captain.
Captain Tarkin,
I never thought I'd see you again. And you brought friends.
Devising a plan to escape that involves splitting up, much to Tarkin's dismay, the teams make their escape. Anakin, Tarkin, and his team make use of the old data to escape using abandoned tunnels, while Obi-Wan's team plants explosives to destroy a section of the Citadel and cause a distraction. Things finally seem to be going according to plan, but Tarkin is not convinced.
It's when things do not go as planned that concerns me. What then?
It's when things don't go as planned that we Jedi are at our best. Trust me.
I deserve my trust for those who take action, General Skywalker.
Then let me remind you, we rescued you back there, and I reserve my trust for those who understand gratitude, Captain Tarkin.
Before we begin, a brief message from Now Playing.
Is the man who works with you a real man, or is he an imposter? The life you live, is it real, or a memory implanted by recall? Your dog, is it real, or is it a replicant? Such are the questions asked in stories by classic sci-fi author Philip K. Dick. Dick's stories have been adopted into such hit films as Blade Runner, Minority Report, Total Recall, Screamers, and the upcoming Matt Damon starring The Adjustment Bureau. You can remember and relive these classic sci-fi films with the Now Playing Philip K. Dick Retrospective Series. Go to NowPlayingPodcast.com each Friday and join Stuart, Jacob, and Brock as they watch and review each of these films. From Blade Runner to Imposter, A Scanner Darkly to Next, we've watched them all in preparation for our review of The Adjustment Bureau, which will be posted the weekend of that film's release, March 4th, 2011. And check out our sister podcast, Books and Nachos, each week as Stuart reviews the original short stories and novels that inspired these films. A new book review will be posted every Friday at booksandnachos.com. So head to nowplayingpodcast.com and find out if the life you're living is really your own.
Now, before we get into our discussion of the episode, why don't we go around and get everyone's initial thoughts and feelings on The Citadel? We'll start with Jen.
All right. I really liked this episode. I thought this was one of the best ones we've had in a really long time, which was a big jump from last week. So I was really happy. I thought there was a lot of thought put into the episode. I feel like little things made sense when in other episodes we've seen stuff that just my suspension of disbelief can kind of let it go, but they bother me. This one, I felt like for the most part, someone really thought everything through and it worked for me. And even Tarkin, people were complaining, oh, it's awful. It's going to be Greedo all over again. But I thought Tarkin worked. I liked it. It's pretty good. So I'm looking forward to the next two episodes in this.
All right. Nathan P.
I liked the episode. It wasn't really one of my favorites from the season so far because it has been a very good season minus the last couple of weeks here. I think the use of the little details, like Jen said, was mostly pretty well done. If anything, the thing that it left me feeling like was that I had just been watching what felt like a Star Wars video game, for lack of a better term. Characters have to get across barriers. One character has to infiltrate to undo the barrier for everybody else to be able to get in, scaling past mines and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if it's just that it was a more action-oriented episode, so it felt like that to me, having spent a while playing Killzone 2 in preparation for Killzone 3 this last week, or if it really was a more video game style of storytelling that showed up this week. But that's definitely the impression that it left on me was, wow, Star Wars video game in the making, if they were to go the traditional route for it. So not a bad episode, not a great episode, certainly one that had a unique feel to it.
Okay, Berend.
You know what this episode did for me was it made me excited for what's coming next. And I have to agree with Jen, it was the little things, because it's the little things that make it feel Star Wars-y. For example, when they showed the little six-pack camera that they reused from the original New Hope from the holding cell attack when they're trying to break out the princess, and just little things like that makes it feel Star Wars. And, you know, again, I have to agree with Jen that somebody was just thinking this through, you know, to put that in, because they could have put in a modern kind of one lens camera. But when I saw that, it was easier for me to get into this episode. So I think this episode was a great, welcome, refreshing surprise, getting back into the action without getting into the intrigue of policy and without using magic, you know. So it's getting back into what we're used to. And it was a pretty good story, you know, and I agree with Jen. I think Tarkin worked also. So all in all, it was a great episode.
All right. Thank you, Barrett. Now, I agree. This was a very good episode. I'm not sure if I like this episode so much because of how not Star Wars the last trilogy felt. But the combination of the action and the plotting and just borrowed elements from previous things, like Barrett mentioned, the cameras and the mounted wall lasers that we saw in A New Hope. It was a very good episode. I enjoyed it very much. So I'm looking forward to where they're going. And Tarkin wasn't nearly as horribly used as we all expected. So we start off once again with a newsreel that gives us action that personally I would love to have seen in an episode. I would have loved to have seen how Evan's ship falls under attack. He gets captured. Seeing the Republic get routed to the point of a Jedi being captured would have been something great to see, but instead we got it in a newsreel. That right away kind of felt like a little bit of an awe moment to me, just like, oh, I would have rather seen that than the Jedi Council meeting about it. So in the Jedi Council meeting, we find out that the reason Evan Peel was captured is because he knows of secret hyperspace routes.
This is just another one of those. It really starts to feel repetitive a little bit when over and over again, what is the issue? It's hyperspace routes. Why were they needing to get Jabba the Hutt's favor back in the film? Hyperspace routes. Over and over again, it's hyperspace routes, and it kind of feels like, wow, this really wasn't a very well-traveled galaxy for all of its history, it would seem. But here we get the Nexus route, right, which is supposed to be true to its name, I guess. We've got this hyperspace route that's supposed to link the homeworlds of the Republic, presumably the major worlds of the Republic, and the homeworlds of the Separatists, presumably the major worlds of them. I'm not sure homeworlds makes a lot of sense to use term-wise here. What I found intriguing was it kind of made me sit back and say, maybe this mission's going to be a failure. Or even if not, maybe this mission is going to get these in the hands of Palpatine, who, as Sidious, would give them to the Separatists, because they make the comment about how this could lead to an attack on something like Coruscant. And of course, that is what we see in the opening of Revenge of the Sith and in the latter moments of that Genndy Tartakovsky series, along with the Labyrinth of Evil novel and the web strip that connect to it. But we see that happen. So is this a setup for that, or is this a red herring?
Yeah, I have to wonder if that's a little bit of a setup. After all the rigmarole the Jedi are going to go through to make sure this information is delivered safely, we'll get some kind of scene where Captain Tarkin and Evan Peel are handing over the numbers to Palpatine, and then as soon as they leave the room, he puts in a call to Dooku and says, here's the coordinates. Let's get this going.
I like the idea that they're kind of coming back to this hyperspace route thing, just because it makes it, to me, more analogous of Earth military problems. I know, like, in a lot of wars, not so much now because we have fighter airborne trans, but in older wars, the biggest problem with troops and things like that is like, getting supplies to them. And if you cut off the supply routes for an army, you've completely crippled the army. So I kind of appreciate that it's not some super weapon du jour that they have to go and worry about. It's something practical. It doesn't bother me. I thought it was better. I prefer that immensely to something like the Malevolence stuff.
I agree with Jen. Hyperspace routes are something that's integral to warfare, but it's also integral in Star Wars. You know, spice routes. You hear Han talking about spice routes and him getting boarded and stuff. And if you know these routes, you know, through space, because it's not like dust and crops, boys and girls, that it kind of makes sense. You know, so I like callbacks. It's just as good as anything else. And
you know, the thing about the whole hyperspace routes thing to me, it's not so much that it's repetitive. I mean, it does get kind of repetitive, but it is sort of a practical concern. But between that and all the different stories, especially in the spinoff materials, where it's all about we need the resources of this planet, we need this mineral or this whatever, agrasite over and over again, for example, it's like we're losing sort of that grandiose, fun atmosphere of Star Wars a lot of the time, and it becomes much more of a war grind. And I mean, I know the Clone Wars is this big galactic conflict. Of course, it's a war. Of course, it's going to have that war grind to be somewhat realistic. But it feels as though the more we get into that realism, the less fun it becomes. I mean, it's kind of like the concerns that people had when the New Jedi Order came about in the novel series. Well, it's getting so dark. Now what? And the Clone Wars, it's getting so dark. Now what? It seems like the fun factor starts to disappear when you get away from those big galactic spanning, holy crap, whether it's super weapons or anything else, they can definitely be overdone. They've been overdone plenty before. But when you get down to sort of that just nitty gritty, it's a hyperspace route or it's resources again. I don't know. It starts to lose that feel of adventure to me. It'd be nice if it was something else. I mean, even if it was something small that was just a MacGuffin like the Kyber crystal that we saw in the Holocron back in the Holocron heist and Children of the Jedi or Children of the Force or whatever it was, Children of the Force, I guess. All of those types of MacGuffins at least feel distinct, feel Star Wars-y. We know it's just something they're going after, but it doesn't have that same war slog feel to it, I guess, is what I guess that's why it gets to me.
You know, I will say this. It's just the way, again, that the Star Wars universe handles information. It's like nothing's on a thumb drive, nothing's on a hard drive. It's always like in this one location, You know, it's in Evan Peel's head, these roots. You know, it's in R2-D2's canister body. It's like nobody ever copies anything. Nobody can transmit thing over space. It's just the way they handle information can get a little confusing. But, you know, I've kind of come along to that's the way that they handle information. But that's just like an old gripe. But that was the thing that really that got to me is just the way they handle the information.
That brings up a good point, though, because I actually really liked the way they handled the information in this, that they split it. Because, again, that just made sense as opposed to just having me in one guy's head. Or I thought it would make more sense to erase the computer core and have it in someone's head, which is a lot harder to get at than just a flash drive that they can, you know, grab it out of the guy's pocket. So I actually really liked that part, especially when it came to light that it was, you know, only partial information in the Jedi. So I'm sorry, Baron.
You know, in order to store that inside Tarkin's head, they had to take away all of his personality except the part that makes him a jerk.
All right, so the Jedi Council meeting is convened. Anakin, Obi-Wan, and a smattering of clones and arcs have their assignment. And in the hallway, Ahsoka finds out the bad news. She's not invited on this trip. She's still, maybe she's grounded after her little trip down the dark side of Mortis or something. She's not allowed to come. Not that she's going to listen. Did anybody actually expect her not to come? I got my hopes up for a second, but then seeing I remember how, she was in more the preview.
Seeing as how the entire first chunk of this episode was already done in comic form by the guy who came up with this idea for them for season one when they couldn't use it, and now they've reused it and literally reused the vast majority of what he did, no surprise whatsoever. I like the fact that it wasn't that she was in the meeting and then she's told you can't go because it's too dangerous. It's that she shows up. She's like, oh, I just heard about the meeting. It was something subtle that I didn't even notice the first time I watched it. But when rewatching, I was like, oh, they left her out. And she thought she just missed being notified or something. But no, they flat out left her out of the meeting. They weren't even going to tell her about what was going on. I think that makes a little bit more sense from the standpoint of, you know, a command structure to say, if she's not involved with the mission, we're specifically leaving her out. Let's not have her be in the meeting that talks about this mission because she's going to want to go. It was a nice touch. And it, again, plays into Anakin's whole thing about attachment. You know, that's not a risk that I'm willing to share, he says. And they play into this idea of something else. Also, just in that little conversation, I think a lot of fans sat back and went, huh, as soon as they mentioned this idea of a super prison for Jedi that go rogue. I wonder if any of the Lost 20 are in there at this point. It reminded me of, what was it called, like 42 or something like that, where in the Marvel comics recently they set up like a super prison for super villains, basically, or those who wouldn't go with the Registration Act. I don't know, it's been a while since I read any of the Civil War background stuff. But I like the idea because it's something that felt obvious. We really hadn't seen all that much before. Lots of good stuff coming out of that really quick scene.
I love the look that Obi-Wan gives Anakin when she's like, can I come too? Just putting that out there. That was a really great animation piece because that made me laugh out loud. It looked like Ewan McGregor. I loved it.
So while Ahsoka chews on that news for a little bit, we meet R2 and his trio of battle droids, much to C-3PO's dismay.
And can I ask, why was C-3PO even there? At this point, he is Padme's droid. So let's blow this whole, psst, there's a secret marriage between Padme and Anakin by constantly having C-3PO where he doesn't really need to be. We need someone there to be able to have that quasi-conversation with R2-D2 to get, oh, he's controlling the droids and everything, like Tin. That makes sense, but why it would be C-3PO there doesn't make any sense. What possible reason could C-3PO have had to be there at that time in having anything at all to do with this mission or the preparation for it, or just being in the hangar in the first place? He's Padme's protocol droid at this point.
Anthony Daniels needed a couple dollars.
Why is C-3PO anywhere? The comic relief. I loved C-3PO there. Whenever he's there, I mean, C-3PO cries more than John Boehner when he's on a space mission. You know what I'm saying? So it's always fun when C-3PO shows up.
It's funny, but it still doesn't logically fit that the character would be there in the first place. I mean, it'd be funny to throw Jar Jar when he's not being a complete idiot into different scenes. I mean, I'm sure Jar Jar would have been great, hilarious slapstick in trying to deal with all those mines climbing up the side of the cliff. But you don't put Jar Jar there because the logic doesn't make sense. You put C-3PO in the hangar, he's got to have a reason for being there. What was he doing? Delivering something there to Anakin from Padme? Oh, wait! Secret, folks! Try to keep it, since we're already in the hangar. While we're still in the hangar, one thing that we probably ought to mention is that we've got Echo and Fives back. And they're, you know, doing the banter and such, and we see them in the briefing and everything. It's great to see these characters come back, because they're minor characters. But it's like every time we've seen them, they've progressed a little bit more. They started out, of course, as cadets and clone cadets. They're rookies in Rookies. They eventually are ARC troopers by, I guess, the end of ARC troopers. They wind up getting their promotions and such. But we see them prove themselves in battle leading up to becoming ARC troopers. And here they are, ARC troopers. It really was cool to see them. It's Leland Chi made a tweet about this at one point over the weekend saying that every time we see them, it seems like they've gone up in rank and they've changed their clothes. They change their clothes more frequently than Padme is the joke, you know. But it was cool to see them back again. These could have been any random clone characters like Charger, the one who falls to his death, or Longshot, who dies inside. All these generic clones they just come up with and they're one-offs. But here's two characters back that we're familiar with. It added a nice touch, one of those small touches that Jim was talking about earlier.
I loved that those two got to be in it, and I feel like it helped the episode because it kind of upped the risk a little bit. These weren't just unnamed clones. These are characters that at least I personally have an attachment to. I really like them. And so I was kind of nervous for them after what they did to King Katunko. I was afraid that they were going to be one of the ones who got fried or, you know, dropped off a bridge or cliff or something. So I feel like it adds a little bit because we don't know what happens to these guys. And there's a perfectly good possibility that they could die at any minute. So if I wasn't afraid for Anakin and Obi-Wan, I was at least worried about them.
And there's two more episodes to go in the trilogy.
I'm making a prediction right now, Jen. They're going to get it. Somebody has to sacrifice. That's why they're here. I'm saying it right now. That's why Echo and Fives are here at the Citadel, because they're going to get it. I'm making a prediction right now. Somebody's going to have to. They're not going to be able. They're not supposed to break away from this jail. This is like the ultimate supermax for Jedis. So I don't see, you know, I don't see Cody. Oh, and I don't see Rex getting it. Fives and them have been around a long time, and I think they're going to get the Tordarian death.
You know, Baron, I would have disagreed with you had they not taken out the Resolute recently. I think we're finally to the point where they're willing to take some risks with characters and circumstances that, granted, were created just for this show, but ones we become familiar with. Katunko, he was sort of a background character throughout. He's never really been our perspective heroic character, but these two guys have, and with the Resolute gone, I think I'm actually in agreement with you. Unlike, I guess, last episode where we disagreed about pretty much everything.
Dude, if that stupid one clone that's still masked and alive at the end of this episode makes it and Echo and Fives don't, I'm really unhappy.
No, I can totally see one of them getting it because, I mean, they love to kill clones that they name and show up for a few episodes and then they die. Like, Denal, his figure started showing up on pegs and he dies. So maybe, you know what, maybe Fives and Echo are safe until they make figures of them. As soon as they make figures, they're going to die.
I think they're going to die in these episodes being tortured by Sobek, the prison master, because they refuse to give him more cowbell.
They do have a action figure, actually. Echo came single carded on the red and white cards, and Fives actually came in the, I believe it was the Target exclusive double packs, or their Walmart exclusive double packs. It came packaged with Yoda. So they already have their prerequisite to get shot up.
Not in their new armor. That's their old armor.
Well, we're lucky they made it to some new armor. And so let's talk about their armor. I like the fact that Echo has that handprint that Rex gave him way back in Rishi Outpost attack. And, I mean, they keep bringing that back, and I think that's great. I don't know if they put another handprint or if they just added the pauldrons on his shoulder. But I mean, to have that, I mean, it makes him stand out. Obviously they just don't call him Echo, but to have that handprint, I mean, it's just, that's great. And I can't wait for that action figure to come out. I'm all over it.
All right. So the bright idea that Anakin has is everybody's going to get carbon frozen for transport to the Citadel. And apparently, as we see, this is a job that only Ugnaughts can do, as they're here doing it too.
Because they came here illegally, and that's a job that regular citizens of Coruscant just won't do. It's an example of the rate, I mean, was it species profiling, whatever we would call it, but it's the same thing as the Twi'leks, who are always the dancers, and the Twi'lek Jedi, who never wear regular clothing and everything. I think I made the joke in the last episode, I don't know if it actually got in there during our discussion, though, about how, whoa, you know, here we are. Maybe the problem is that in The Empire Strikes Back, he's not sure about it because it's Ugnaughts running it. Maybe it's species' stuff, and yet here is freaking Ugnaughts again, one of whom even gets a name, Urk Zalas, even though he shows up for a second. I'm not even sure where the name came from, unless it was from some type of guidebook or maybe one of the magazines or something.
I didn't realize he was named.
I took it totally opposite. I love that the Ugnaughts were there, and it kind of kept going with the whole things aren't what they always seem to be as, like, because I always thought of Ugnaughts as being evil. You know, who would carbon freeze a human besides an evil person? But it was refreshing that Ugnaughts are not evil, that maybe they're the only ones who perfected this technology and they're the only ones who can be trusted to do it right. And that's why Ugnaughts are the ones who are carbon freezing, you know, our heroes here. And I thought it was a great kickback, you know, and I thought the character of the Ugnaught looked way cuter than he was supposed to. I wish they kind of uglied him, Ugnaughted him up a little bit more. But I thought that was a great callback, you know, to, you know, the Uggies. Not that nobody else wants to do the job, but they're the only ones who can do it.
Yeah. Now, how Anakin would know that this would work, and how we know that hibernation sickness, which Obi-Wan calls carbon sickness, which I'm assuming is meant to be the same thing, how we know that that will not affect them, they don't really explain, but it showed up in the comic that winds up using the same storyline, so we'll hear that in Continuity Corner. In a broader standpoint, though, from the standpoint of continuity, I must say this kind of does the same thing for me as seeing the Well of the Dark Side last week did, because the Well of the Dark Side, looking very much like Mustafar, I know is going to change the way I see that sequence in Revenge of the Sith, now that I've got that imagery in my mind and that story point from Mortis, you know, kind of sitting back there as something that Anakin has gone through before. Kind of similar here. It strikes me that now it's not that Vader wasn't sure, Anakin/Vader wasn't sure in The Empire Strikes Back that carbon freezing would work on a human being when he's freezing Han. It's he's not sure if that facility could handle the carbon freezing. Doesn't he say at one point the facility should be adequate to freeze Solo for his trip to, or Skywalker for his trip to the Emperor? They're going to test it on Captain Solo. It's not that he doesn't know that it'll work. It's that, well, he's not sure about that particular place. And it certainly, it doesn't make a significant change to it, but it certainly changes the context in which that conversation happens. And I know that's going to jump to my mind the next time I see The Empire Strikes Back. I like that what they're doing sometimes with these scenes and these settings is that in using these things that we've seen before, making these callbacks, so to speak, they're giving us added context without necessarily contradicting a bunch of stuff that would cause us to question what we see later. It just shifts our viewpoint just a little bit. I dig it.
You dig it. I dig it, Nathan, because now we get Obi-Wan in carbonite, we get Anakin in carbonite, we get Ahsoka in carbonite, we get Fives, we get Echo, we get... You know, now we have all of these Clone Wars characters in carbonite that are potential figures. And I think that is totally awesome. I mean, I could see him selling a battle pack with all of the carbonite figures. For me, it doesn't ruin the exclusivity of carbon freezing for Solo. It just enhanced it because it's so exciting when you see that process. And I am totally jazzed that they brought it into the Clone Wars. And I cannot wait for these figures to come out.
It kind of also, you could say, adds a little bit to the malice, I guess, of Jabba the Hutt towards Han Solo, because here they're in and out of carbonite very quickly. They don't have any of the hibernation sickness issues. Whereas Han is up on the wall for 9 months. And when he finally gets thawed out, he's got hibernation sickness. This is something that would not have affected him had Jabba not chosen the malicious and rather snarky method of how he dealt with Han when he arrived. Had he thawed him out right then, he probably would have been fine. Instead, he hangs him up. And not only is there that indignity, but now he's got the hibernation sickness to go with it. I think, again, it's giving a little bit of a perspective shift, but adding more so than detracting from what we've seen before.
I love that they had the hibernation, the carbon freezing, be Anakin's idea also, because it made it, it's unorthodox, but doesn't sound like something unheard of. But I want to make the comment, a lot of people were complaining about it last we saw it, because there seemed to be an assumption that kind of Han Solo was kind of the only one who'd ever had this happen. And that just never occurred to me when I was watching the original films, because Leia knows what hibernation sickness is. You would think that if he were the first one who had ever encountered this kind of carbon freezing on a human, they would have no idea what with him. So I think it's perfect. I think it makes sense. It's probably something that doesn't happen very often, maybe only for like criminals, something rare, someone who's really ill and needs to be transferred long distance. But Anakin thinks to use it in an unorthodox way, and then he just uses it again later, which I thought was perfect. I think it brings a whole depth, like you were saying, Nathan, to the character moment in Empire.
I also like the nice touch that all the clones had to have their helmets off. As if, you know, to affect them biologically, it needs to be something that somehow gets in through, you know, maybe they got to breathe in the stuff while they're in the chamber or whatever. They didn't just put on the helmet to get frozen that way. They had to have their faces available, faces accessible, I guess, to the process. I don't know if that was just a choice because it would look cooler in carbonite that way or if they thought it through that way. But again, nice little touch.
Now, shortly before this scene, Ahsoka goes to talk to Plo Koon to discuss Anakin's decision, which she's none too happy about. And he gives her some advice, which I didn't think he was really telling her to go ahead and go. Did I miss something there? Did everybody else see that he was actually hinting she should go ahead and do it anyway?
I don't think it was that he was supposed to be hinting that she should do it anyway, so much as that's where we leave the conversation. Like, you've got the whole, he is your master. It's like, it's his authority to decide whether you go on the mission or not. But then when she makes her argument about whether or not it's her life to choose to risk, you got that moment right before it switches scenes where it shows Plo's face, and it's almost like he's contemplating what she's saying, and then we cut away. And then when we see them take off, we hear Plo give his comment, you know, as the ship is flying away, whatever it was, like, good luck or whatever he says, you know, the may the force be with you, good luck, you know, see you later. And you almost think that he's possibly saying that to Ahsoka, because that's the most recent person we've seen him in conversation with, almost as if somewhere in what we didn't see off screen, she convinces him. Otherwise, when she shows up, she's flat out lying about having orders from Plo to be there. She says she has an order from Plo that disobeyed an order from Anakin, then talks about how following orders isn't always best, even though she just used the excuse of having an order to follow to be there. Yeah, very poorly written logic sequence there.
Yeah, she's just talking like a teenager.
Yeah, she struck me as that snarky teenager disobedience kind of role model there. And she's already there, so it doesn't really matter what she says. She can kind of just make it Anakin feel better by fibbing about Master Plo. But I'm pretty sure she just kind of sneaked in there.
It brings another facet to Ahsoka in this episode, because Ahsoka is everywhere. She's doing what she wants. She even says that, you know, like you said, Nathan, that following orders, she has learned that following orders is not always the right thing to do. And if that is not the seeds of the dark side, I don't know what is.
Is what happened on Mortis possibly why Anakin wanted to leave her behind in the first place? He's seen the risks go to their most extreme point. His Padawan goes Sith. His Padawan dies. Is this going to make him more protective of her now? And that's why he wants to leave her behind. This could be a whole escalation in the relationship between them and what ultimately leads to her leaving,
you know, and or that dying. Would certainly, you know, that would almost put us in the position then that the Mortis trilogy, not only does it not cause Anakin to deviate from his path, it perhaps accelerates the path that he's on. Because had it not been for that incident, if he wasn't quite as... Assuming that his attachment to Ahsoka is part of the attachment issue that leads him eventually to have such an extreme attachment to Padme that winds up blowing up in everybody's face in Revenge of the Sith, then this... That the whole process would have been accelerated where it's even going to be worse than it perhaps was before, where good old father, by erasing Anakin's memory, maybe he didn't do a good enough job. Maybe the future that had to happen is perhaps now still altered, not just because Anakin knows what they've gone through, but because of his reactions to it. What got me about the scene, though, as far as the do as I say, not as I do thing, following orders isn't the best option and everything like that, Obi-Wan... I think it was Barrett last episode who talked about how Obi-Wan was a jerk in that episode. I didn't really see it, but the emphasis was made in the last Republic Forces about how Obi-Wan was being a jerk, and he certainly feels like it here. His response about, oh, I see that Anakin's teaching method is do as I say, not as I do. If I was Anakin, I would be pissed. That is outright undermining his authority as her master. If I was a teacher, which I am, and some administrator came in, somebody above me came in, and when I got done disciplining a student over something, turned around and did something completely the opposite and undermined that authority, I would be taking that to the principal, and I would be pissed. And yet here, Obi-Wan is just tossing out the comment there and undermining Anakin's authority like it's nothing. I would think of all people, Obi-Wan would be the one to want to keep the respect for the, for lack of a better term, the chain of command or chain of apprenticeship.
I thought that the scene when they come out of the carbon freezing, I thought that was the best scene in the whole episode. And I didn't get that Obi-Wan was a joke. I thought he was just kind of having fun with Anakin the way he kind of always kind of has fun with Anakin. Because it seems that Obi-Wan is amused that Anakin cannot control his Padawan. And it's kind of like, you know, you'll see when you have kids what they'll do to you type of thing. And I think he's just kind of having fun with it. But the whole scene where they come out of the carbon freezing and Anakin looks to his left and he says, "Hey, Snips." And she's like, "Hey, Master." And then he has that look. And I thought that was great. I thought it was the best line. Am I having carbon freezing sickness or is that Ahsoka? You
know? it's a funny scene, but at the same time,
it's the best scene in the whole thing.
You know, when you have kids, as a parent, if the grandparents who are like, "Ha ha, you were like that when you were your child's age," if the grandparent then is undermining the parental authority, is that not a reason for the parent to be ticked off? I mean, granted, it makes sense within the context of, well, that's what human beings do. Well, yeah, but just because it's what human beings do doesn't mean that the natural human reaction then being annoyed shouldn't follow, because it certainly would in real life, it would seem.
Speaking as a parent, and yes, that is. And that's what happens, though, with grandparents and parents, and they doom you to have children just like you. And then when you do, they go behind you and undo all of your parenting with your children, and it just makes you want to find them a really crappy nursing home that straps them down and feeds them with a slingshot. I saw both sides with that conversation. I saw Obi-Wan kind of the jeering, "Ha, now you're getting it after all the crap you gave me." But on the other hand, I also saw Obi-Wan kind of cutting Anakin down in front of the clones, and that's something that should be done, you know, joke around like that behind closed temple doors, not in front of the armor.
But they do that all the time to Anakin, and that just goes to why he's so upset, why he feels disrespected in episode 3.
Yeah, no wonder he kills them all.
Yeah, no wonder why, because he is this. He's like Asher and Blood and Spartacus. You know, he's always getting talked down to. You know, nobody's ever getting respect. He's this great warrior. And so it builds up to why he reacts like that in episode 3. So it all fits for me.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, get you back in episode 3. There you go. There's your song for the episode.
You know, Barrett, now that you bring that up, wow, that makes the whole beginning part where Anakin's kind of pouty and mad about not being a master, that makes that just completely different, because now it's like, man, you guys are always disrespecting me.
Well, even he feels that even in episode 2, the idea, I mean, right before he throws stuff in Padme's apartment, what's he say? You know, he's holding me back. I mean, he's annoyed at the fact that it seems like everybody is keeping him in check, even though he's supposed to be the chosen one. I'm wondering, though, if that is something that they're purposely trying to work into this storytelling, or if it's just a matter of they wanted some quick, witty banter from Obi-Wan, and they just tossed it in there. It's leaving a definite impression of the relationship between these two that I don't think is the type of relationship they're aiming for. I mean, I get the whole they were brothers, but I don't think what they're going for is the older younger brother and the older brother constantly picking on him thing. That would seem to undermine the relationship rather than build it, but it's probably by accident.
I'm afraid that may be giving them more credit than they actually should be getting.
In an episode where it seems like the details are what we're so excited about? I don't know.
That's true.
We're really going just off on this topic. Yeah, there's an edit point earlier.
We're like 5 minutes in to the episode and an hour into discussion.
Or something.
Yeah, but but their relationship, you know, this is what we're seeing. This is what has been discussed since episode 4, though. You know, since Obi-Wan sat down Luke in Obi-Wan's cave on Tatooine, and he says that I was a friend of your father's. I fought in the Clone Wars with your father. And so now, you know, I think it deserves a 5-minute discussion, because this is the relationship we're seeing. This is what's building Anakin up, where he's feeling like he can't trust anybody but Palpatine. Nobody takes him seriously but Palpatine. You know, not even his Padawan will listen to him. And he's this great warrior. So I think it, you know, it was it may just be some witty banter, but I think it's just building up to the reason why he turns and why it's not so easy for him to turn, but why he does turn. Because if you feel like you're the only one, you're going to go to path of least resistance, which was the Emperor. So that's how I feel about it.
I took it more as it was they were trying to almost portray how close Anakin and Obi-Wan were by how comfortable Obi-Wan is kind of tweaking Anakin's tail all the time. I could see how that would get really obnoxious and probably would cause Anakin to pout in episode 3. But I don't know, Anakin's kind of annoys the crap out of Obi-Wan sometimes too. So I took it as just kind of this mutual picking at each other out of not affection, but just being so comfortable with each other. That's kind of almost a comfort thing, just kind of snapping a little bit at each other, kind of like siblings who've been together for a long time.
Moving right along, the Jedi and their clones make their way to the Citadel after a variety of obstacles that they managed to overcome with the loss of, well, there was that one guy that died. It was a shame there. But
Charger.
Poor Charger. And we find out it is a good thing they did bring Ahsoka tagged along after all. But finally, the Jedi are inside the Citadel.
If I may ask, point of logic, it's great to have Spider Ahsoka with them. She even does like the little upside down thing. I was waiting for somebody to come out and kiss her upside down. But it's like gravity doesn't work with these characters. As they are sitting there discussing stuff, it's like there's no gravity pulling on them at all. It looks like Anakin's kind of like leisurely laying up against the cliff face. Obi-Wan's just kind of hanging around, pun intended. Ahsoka's kind of leaning off by one arm. And then somehow, this thing that it's taken them all this time to climb up, Ahsoka just dashes up the entire rest of it to get up to the top in order to get inside and sort of do the video game thing and open up the ray shields. And this is immediately after Obi-Wan has managed to avoid the droids detecting him, because apparently super battle droids don't know that when you step outside to look for intruders and such, or threats, you don't apparently look, you know, down. And then, of course, they're going to wind up fighting special commando droids that are apparently trained for the circus, doing acrobatics everywhere that they go. I got a lot of issues with the small nuances. It's a fun episode from an action sequence, this whole breaching thing, but there are times where I just sit back and go, what? That I didn't notice on the first viewing.
There were some finer details that if you sit and think about it. I mean, why is there a door in the side of a cliff? For no reason. It goes nowhere. There's no landing pad. There's just a door and a balcony because, you know, sometimes the droids like to go outside and take their lunch on the balcony. Oh, wait, no.
And why do you have droids as guards of prisoners in the cell with them rather than outside? So that the people who would be repelled by the droids have to already be inside before they can do anything about it. And why is it that they're running around with a bag full of explosive charges that are apparently metal, and when the magnetic ceiling gets activated, somehow Anakin's arm magnetizes him to the ceiling through his clothing, but what, the different charges don't get zipped up to the ceiling, unless perhaps I just missed that it was part of the ceiling, and I'm just kind of babbling incoherently on that. And if the clone armor is a plastoid alloy composite, okay, alloy, metal, why don't the clones go zipping up towards the ceiling on this? Cool scene, but the logic slowly but surely starts to fall apart on the second viewing. Then again, there's sounds in space.
You're getting a little nitpicky there, Nathan. Remember, it was just a cartoon.
I know. It was just one of those things where I watched it the second time, and we always try to watch this with a critical eye so that, you know, we sometimes maybe come off sounding a little too critical, but we try to break down the episode, what worked and what didn't. And on the second viewing, that left me kind of scratching my head. On the first viewing, I really enjoyed it. It's kind of like a lot of the stuff from the Mortis trilogy, except, of course, for Ghosts of Mortis, where on the first viewing, didn't really bug me. But on the second viewing, certain little nitpicky things started to bother me. And I think it was weird because you would think if they're doing all those small little references here, all those little fine details we're finding so good about this episode, that they would have thought through these fine issues too. Just like, why was C-3PO in the hangar bay? That sort of thing. You would think that there would have been some extra push in the direction of, let's make sure that all the logic works out throughout.
I don't know. Those things didn't bother me at all. And I was actually looking for problems in the episode because the last one had been so annoying to me. I don't really think these things are things that can be... I think these are easily explained for the most part. The explosives don't necessarily have to be metal. They could be some sort of... There are explosive putties. There are explosive non-metal composite chemicals. It's possible that they could be like that. I don't think it's a big deal. And the door to nowhere, there's nothing that says that there's not a landing strip or something that can extend out. It's security. They don't have a lot out there because, you know, whatever's coming to them has to provide some sort of walking space, and then they drop it off and they leave. It makes it that much more difficult to get in and out. It's kind of like Alcatraz. And that didn't bother me at all. I thought it made enough sense. We don't see everything, so making, you know, assumptions that that's all there is to it, I don't really know if that's worth worrying about. Seeing as they got so much right in this episode, I feel like maybe it's not really worth being concerned over.
I wouldn't say concerned, just felt odd on that second viewing. It felt somewhat, for lack of a better term, having myself wonder about those things kicked me out of the episode a little bit more so than a lot of the other episodes we've seen that maybe didn't have as many fine details to them, but at the same time felt like the logic held up a little bit better just on that second viewing.
Oh, I hear what Jen's saying. She's saying, hey, this could have been a fourth Mortis episode. Shut up. So when we get to the Citadel at some point, we meet this fabulous new alien who talks like Christopher Walken, Ossie Sobeck. Who we find out is also voiced by James Arnold Taylor, Obi-Wan Kenobi. And really, this, I like this guy. He's great.
I like the whole Hamlet talking to himself thing. Yes, we built this citadel so that we could keep in the Jedi and such. And all the droids around him are like, yes, sir, we already know that. We've been here too.
What this character did was he was believable that he could run this jail. You could believe that this guy could run a jail of Supermax for Jedi. You know, he wasn't a pushover. And I really appreciated this new character. Is he a new character model, or did they kind of just use the Bosk and color him up a little different?
It's a different species, but they may have used some of the same elements to create him. They were reusing elements in this episode, like they reused some of the asteroids and such.
I thought that he was Bosk's species.
No, he's a Findian, but that's a continuity corner thing.
Oh,
I loved him too. I thought he was probably the best villains we've had, like villain that we've had in this series. He wasn't bumbling. He wasn't, you know, one of those mustache twirl for cackling sake type characters. He didn't have some stupid thing like a cough like Grievous did. He was intelligent, and I loved that the minute there was something going on, he wasn't just like, go send someone to see what it is. It was just, you know, lock down, everything shuts down. Get the elite troops. We're not going to mess around with some little, you know, crappy security thing. We're going to get the elites out there and go kill. And that was one of the things that I really love, because usually in cartoon they kind of go up in waves, where like the evil guy will send out the crappy troops, and then he'll send out the mediocre troops, and then we work their way up to the really good guys, and by then they've already planted the explosives or something. So I appreciated that. It made it much more as a high security prison, and his face was really fun to watch. I loved how far back the corners of his mouth, it looked really cool what he looks like, but he was fun to watch.
I always like the fact when the villains aren't scared of the Jedi. And not only was this cat not scared of the Jedi, but he didn't have any respect for the Jedi at all. Like, he was better than the Jedi. The Jedi are scum. And that was, you know, that's the villains we need. You know, that's who Grievous should be. You know, he shouldn't just say Jedi scum, but he should actually, you know, Grievous is always running from the Jedi. This guy was pushing towards the Jedi. You know, he's going after the Jedi. The Jedi were the hunted, and he was the hunter. And I hope this guy comes back, and I hope that in this next the next couple episodes in this arc, you know, I think he might be a big, big villain. I think he may be able to do something special here, especially when you know, this whole arc with Tarkin and everything. I think he may be able to do something special, especially if he's able to kill one of these Jedi. And guess which one it might be?
If somebody has to bite it in this episode to step up the coolness in season 3 by just that much more, if they kill Evan, that will make this season pretty awesome. Not because I want him to die, but because, I mean, now we're going with killing a movie named Jedi. That's a big step for this series. They've killed people that they invented, but they haven't gone into the killing people from movies area yet.
Speaking of Evan Peel, I must say, we are again, just like last week with the suicide and everything, the terrorist bombings back, and I guess it was season 2. Here we are again, pushing the limits of what is or isn't appropriate for children's television, if it's a children's show or who the audience is, that whole question of what's the target audience, because here we've got the torturing of the Jedi, and we have the interrogator droid, the EV-99 looking interrogator droid, basically saying, you know, if you don't answer, we're going to pluck your other eye out. And yet, again, Ventress couldn't kiss the freaking clone.
I could hear Arnie squirming from, like, across states for that part, because I know he has this horrible squick thing with the eye. That creeped me out, and I thought it made it a lot more valid, because at the beginning they show him with the giant Jedi cattle prod, and they're just kind of tasing him, and it's like, well, that's probably painful, but it's not very, you know, there's no threat there. But when he starts reaching for him with that little needle thing on the end of his hand, that was creepy. And I was kind of twitching a little bit in my seat, and I thought that was kind of fun. I liked that they stepped it up like that. I'm sure now the kids are scared of their eyes or something. I liked it.
You know, there was a video game recently. I won't say which one because it would spoil it for those who have been playing it but haven't quite got to the ending yet. There was a video game released recently that has you have to sit in a machine and direct a needle that's coming down into your own eye in order to access parts of the character's brain. And you see it go into the eye. It's freaking creepy. And that was what I mean, just the whole threat of messing with somebody's eye is bad enough as it is. But having just played that game just within the last month or so, as soon as that needle started going toward the eye, I was literally squirming like, oh, yeah. I mean, we knew, or we could assume that, yeah, it wasn't going to happen. It was just a threat. But just the threat of it, having had that very extreme visual in my mind, it's one of the few times this series has ever made me squirm in my seat for anything other than continuity reasons.
Another thing about Evan Peele that's kind of new, his voice. He's Russian. Who would have thunk?
Ivan Peele Govorit Paruski.
Because in the Tartakovsky series, he had that big, deep voice facing the mirror. And this one, I was glad, or maybe I was disappointed. You know, a little bit of both. I could have gone with it either way. I'm glad they stuck with a deeper voice, since that's what we saw before. But on the other hand, if he had talked like a chipmunk, it would have been freaking hilarious.
I was waiting for something like, you know, in Republic Space, Force uses you or something. I actually really liked his accent, but it was kind of distracting because it's so very obviously Russian.
No, Mr. Sobek, I expect you to die.
The one thing I liked about Evan Peele is I found interesting is that I don't think he likes Tarkin at all. I think he only saved Tarkin because Tarkin had, I know he's a Jedi and I know Jedi are supposed to save people, but it just kind of seemed like we got to go get my captain. Like he was kind of being like, I have to do it, you know, because Tarkin has the other pieces of the puzzle, but it didn't seem like he liked Tarkin at all. Yeah, even when he saves him, there was like no love lost between them. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Well, would you like Tarkin in this episode? Can I use the word douchebag on Republic Forces?
I love Tarkin.
I'm serious.
He was a complete, I mean, everything out of his mouth. I mean, it's the first meeting between Tarkin and Kenobi, Tarkin and Skywalker, and it's just like, unless he wanted to be captured, and he's not happy to have been rescued, this is the most ungrateful jerkweed I think we've seen in this series. With Tarkin here, I wanted to slap him the entire time through. It's like they took one element of his character, his snarkiness and his sort of evil villain type of thing from A New Hope, and magnified it here. Not going speciesist with the character, but doing kind of like what they do with the species, where they grab some one element and blow it up. They grab that one element of snarkiness from Tarkin and they blow it up here to create a character that to me was inherently unlikable from the moment he appeared on scene. Not because he's a villain character later, but because he's just a douche in this episode.
He was so much of a jerk that I'm almost wondering if maybe he has an ulterior motive or something, because he was an ass. He was really obnoxious to everybody. And it threw me a little bit because it's like, you know, prison versus, you know, trying to escape. Why are you being such a jerk to everybody? And I don't know. I liked it. It made him interesting, but I'm hoping there was a reason for it and not that they just really went over the top with him.
Those are two great points that both of you make. I kind of have to, I like the way that they handled Tarkin. I like the fact that they took that piece of snarkiness from Tarkin and made a whole character into him, because that's what I know of Tarkin. I'm not supposed to like Tarkin in any incarnation. He's someone that you're supposed to love to hate. They made it to where his snarkiness, his decision-making is the exact same decision-making that would not let him retreat and get blown up when they blew up that Death Star, because he feels strength in numbers will win the day. He has a way of thinking that he knows is going to be right. And this totally, totally went with that character, with the, what I know of Tarkin, that he was trying to disagree with the Jedi. You know, he has his way of thinking, and that is his downfall. That's what brings him down in A New Hope, is the snarkiness. So I, for one, am glad that that's what they brought him. They didn't try to change him up to make him some intellectual, you know, bureaucrat. You know, he's this guy who, I know what I know, you guys are wrong, I got Vader on his leash. You know, he's this same kind of guy. And Jen, you bring up the point, like, what does Tarkin know? Because at the end of episode 3, Tarkin's walking on the bridge with Vader and Palpatine, Emperor Palpatine. So he's already in with them. So how much does Tarkin know? Because he definitely doesn't seem nervous that he's locked up. He doesn't seem nervous at all. It doesn't seem like he has any doubt that he's going to escape this. And, you know, how much does he know?
Yeah, I like the question of, you know, what does he know and what else are we going to learn about the character? I can't imagine they would just bring him in for a cameo appearance. But then again, they did that with Greedo and made a big deal out of it. But the thing about it, though, is, yes, that is what we know of Tarkin in the future. But that's like 20 years hence. So we're saying that this character, who he doesn't have any character development to him whatsoever, nothing about his personality develops over the span of 2 decades. That bothers me a little bit.
I think it actually kind of almost works for Tarkin, because at the end of A New Hope, he's like, you can see how hidebound and how stubborn he is. And there are some people, granted it's not really an interesting character to have, but there are some people who just become more stubborn and more hidebound with age. And they don't really ever change. They're not really the type of person who can admit that there's anything that's wrong with them, or, you know, broken, or anything that needs to be corrected or done better with themselves. So they just kind of stick and they just get more kind of mean as they get older. And I can kind of almost see that for Tarkin. He's like, he looks, by the end of A New Hope, he looks like withered and like a prune. He's just, there's no fun. He is not a happy person. And I can kind of see him coming out of this jerk younger self.
All right. So Tarkin, we already know we're going to love to hate him, and I get the feeling, or this makes me feel that his ending in A New Hope is just that much the better. His own stubbornness gets him blown to smithereens all over space, so it kind of worked for me. But we shall see how it works out in the next 2 episodes, because this episode ends in kind of a cliffhanger.
I was expecting some type of nice, you know, wrap up to the episode. Instead, I got commercials for Bantan Alien Force.
The only other topic I would bring up is the battles. Now, these were some great closed-in Jedi lightsaber swinging battles. I mean, I was very impressed with the way that they were shooting, you know, the way they were lighting the lasers going over the Jedi's head, and how they kind of had the camera angle that was like looking up at the Jedi while they were deflecting the blaster bolts, and all that close quarter fighting and all the lightsabers swinging around and stuff. I thought they did an amazing, amazing job with all of those character models, having all of that individual action that they were doing in those scenes, that I just thought it was amazing. I don't think that this animation is anything less than groundbreaking. And I don't think anything else touches it out there right now, you know. And I just want to give kudos to Mr. Filoni, because the animation, I don't think we've had anything to say about the animation in almost this whole season.
I'm glad you brought up the animation, because there was one little thing that I noticed that was just, it was the fact that they bothered to put it in. I loved Evan's ears. They bounce just the tiniest bit with every step he takes. They didn't have to do that at all. And that's probably was a pain in the butt to animate, but they did that, and it makes his ears look like they're just cartilage and not some, you know, Obi-Wan beard material. And I liked that. They put that much effort in, and it shows they really care that much about the product that they're producing.
Unlike the last 3 episodes, this episode had quite a bit that was affected or did affect previously existing material. So, Nathan, why don't we stroll down Continuity Corner?
Well, folks, now that we're back to an episode in the mainstream universe, rather than some mystical realm, continuity returns in a series of small references and a few larger concerns. Let's check out what was revealed on the StarWars.com episode guide first and expand upon it. The Citadel leader is Ossie Sobek. He is a Findian, which is a species first introduced in the expanded universe with the character Gera Derrida, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Jedi Apprentice: The Dark Rival by Jude Watson, published in 1999. The species was given a distinctive look in The Essential Guide to Alien Species in 2001 by artist R.K. Post. The character is voiced by series regular James Arnold Taylor, and its speech patterns were designed after actor Christopher Walken, who, in turn, needs more cowbell. The tactical droid here, K2B4, is voiced by Ashley Eckstein, and was named after Kobe Bryant. K for Kobe, B for Bryant, and the numbers 2 and 4 for 24, his number, since the character was named just after the Los Angeles Lakers won the championship. The Citadel itself mirrors A New Hope elements, with walls meant to be reminiscent of the surface of the Death Star when seen from afar, and plenty of cameras, security devices, and such, last seen close up in A New Hope's Death Star detention block. The planet Lola Seyu, which might have been inspired by art of Knights of the Old Republic II, the Sith Lord's broken planet Malachor V, is surrounded by asteroids that include reuses of rock chunks from Mortis and Iago earlier in the series. The Sheathapede shuttle, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, again, that R2-D2 flies to Lola Seyu appears to be a new variant of a familiar vessel. This is a class type B, according to the Separatist scans in the episode. This brings us to Evan Peel, who I always said as Even Peel. There go all my Pearl Jam jokes.
Even Peel, something, something, butterflies.
Yeah, I never could tell what the hell Eddie Vedder was saying either. We first met Jedi Master Evan, no longer Even, Peel, as a Jedi Council member in The Phantom Menace, and he appeared sporadically in prequel EU since then, most notably in Jedi Council Acts of War, set just before The Phantom Menace, and Coruscant Knights, Jedi Twilight, set shortly after Revenge of the Sith. Yes, the same series in which author Michael Reeves couldn't keep the dates of the prequels or his own related stories straight to save his life. But that's a rant for another show at another time. Peel also briefly appeared in the earlier Gendy Tartakovsky Clone Wars cartoon. He's a male Lannik, though played by a woman, Michaela Cottrell, in Episode 1, and technically in Episode 2, but that was just stock footage from the previous film, not anything new. Peel's appearance here really has no continuity impact, as long as they don't kill him off, as we've already seen his death during the early months of the Jedi Purge in the expanded universe. Next up, we have a general story item. We have our heroes, Anakin, Obi-Wan, and the clones, needing to get through Separatist scanners to reach their target. To do this, they allow themselves to be carbon frozen and carried as cargo on a small transport piloted by R2-D2 via battle droids that R2 controls. Ahsoka is ordered to stay behind, but after a conversation with an older individual, she is convinced to stow away and join the mission anyway. This description fits this week's episode in February 2011 and September 2008's Shipyards of Doom comic from the Clone Wars Digest series. Apparently, Henry Gilroy, lead writer on the TV series during its first season, and writer of many of its spin-off comics, had discussed this method of getting past scanners with Dave Filoni, but it never made it into the series early on. Gilroy then used it for his comic Shipyards of Doom, only for it now to be reused here in the Citadel. This was really jarring to many of us out there who had already read Shipyards of Doom, and is made a bit more obvious to the community at large, because that was the comic that was given away as a promotional item with the Clone Wars film on DVD. There are concerns right now as to what this episode does to Shipyards of Doom, and whether it kicks that out of continuity in part or entirely. The issue arrives with conversation prior to carbon freezing. In this episode, Anakin notes that it's the first time they've done this. However, the comic, which is set much earlier in the Clone Wars if we're to use costumes and the word of the creative teams as an indication of timing here, has a similar conversation, during which Anakin reveals that he thought of the idea because he'd heard stories on Tatooine of bounty hunters using carbon freezing on troublesome captives. These obviously can't both be the first time this happens, but there's little doubt that Shipyards of Doom is before this week's episode. One wonders how they'll make this work if they intend to keep Shipyards of Doom in the continuity, especially given that it would seem somewhat unlikely that they would immediately turn around and invalidate part of a television series episode, the conversation about this being their first time, just to keep a comic in continuity. My guess? Bye-bye, Shipyards of Doom, or at least part of it. But we'll see. There's no official ruling yet on the matter. By the way, we at least have an answer already, thanks to Shipyards of Doom, ironically, for why no one experiences any form of hibernation sickness in this episode. According to Anakin in the comic, again, remember, by Henry Gilroy, one of the developers of the series and lead writer for Season 1, such a trip taken in this episode, and in Shipyards of Doom, is too short to cause hibernation sickness, Remember, Han was in Carbonite for 9 months. This is just a matter of hours or days. Of course, the big reveal in this episode was the appearance of Will Huff Tarkin, first portrayed by Peter Cushing in A New Hope, and briefly by Wayne Pygram, Farscape's Scorpius in Revenge of the Sith. How this fits in with Tarkin's background is cause of some confusion, but not because of this episode per se. Tarkin is one of those characters that everyone tends to want to use one way or another, but over the years, there hasn't been a lot of consistency in his ranks, or even whether or not he was in the military at any given time. Tarkin is sort of a constantly evolving character. For example, we didn't even know that he and his wife, Thalassa, even had a son, Garrosh, until the recent release of the first issue of Darth Vader and the Lost Command. We have, however, seen his brother Gideon, cousin Ranulph, and niece Rivoche, so it is another Star Wars family tree that's been developed over the years. So what do we know? We know that after graduating from a military academy, Tarkin joined the Republic Outland Region Security Force alongside his brother Gideon. He had reached the rank of commander by the time he met Wraith Sinar around 39 BBY, 17 years before the Clone Wars began. However, he apparently retired from the military and entered politics, becoming the civilian lieutenant governor of the Sesuena sector, which included his homeworld Iriadu, by the year before the Phantom Menace. Within the next few years after the Phantom Menace, he aligned himself with Palpatine during the early steps toward the New Order and left office as lieutenant governor to have his military commission reactivated. He was an officer in this respect when encountering Wraith Sinar again during the events of the novel Rogue Planet, 7 years before Attack of the Clones. By the time of that film's Battle of Geonosis and the outbreak of the Clone Wars, though, Tarkin was back out of the military and in civilian politics again, now as governor, not lieutenant governor this time, of the same place he'd been before, Sesuena Sector, including Iriadu. He was in that position early in the war, according to the Expanded Universe, but he apparently had his commission reactivated again to serve in the Clone Wars, during which he discovered Queezux's homeworld of Amwat, for instance. Here, we see him as a captain, which could be an actual rank or just a generic title as the ship's top officer, but probably the former. By the end of the Clone Wars, he will be among the first promoted to the rank of Moff, and then later the first Imperial Grand Moff. When and how this promotion to Moff takes place is a bit iffy, as it was originally said to be after the Gorman Massacre, an early EU concept from the West End Games RPG, wherein the slaughter of rebels on Gorman helped spark the Rebel Alliance's creation. This actually would have fit with this episode, as he was a captain in the Imperial Navy at the time and promoted afterward, a promotion that the Essential Chronology clarified as being from Naval Captain to Moff. However, more recent sources have suggested that he went from the Navy to being a governor yet again near the end of the Clone Wars, and then the term Moff was bestowed upon him based on that governor position, and the Gorman Massacre, while something he was involved in, was much later. In other words, the man is a pinball when it comes to rank and position. He has simply been bounced around by various sources over the years and just goes wherever the flippers smack him. I highly doubt we will ever see a truly coherent and cohesive answer to the question of the path that Tarkin took to his final destination, no pun intended, aboard the Death Star. But hey, at least Stephen Stanton did a decent job with the voice. I do wonder, though, if the Tarkin we see in this episode is even the Tarkin we know. I mean, underneath that giant triangular head, he might be an Arkona. Just saying.
Now, if you notice, there's a slight difference in the sound of my voice at this point. That was a pre-recorded continuity corner because there is so much stuff to it. Since that was recorded just 24 short hours ago, I did get a chance to contact Leland Chi about the whole issue of Shipyards of Doom as it pertains to this episode and the whole issue of carbon freezing. And according to Leland, what he says is that, yes, the Citadel will be the first time that Anakin tries this trick. As for Shipyards of Doom, whether it gets completely kicked out, or if it gets rearranged, or how they deal with it, really kind of is up in the air, because until something else references it, there's not really a need to go back to it as long as we know the Citadel is the real first time that it happens. So, given the fact that the Clone Wars Digest is almost never referenced even by itself, I don't expect there to be much of a ruling on the status of Shipyards of Doom anytime soon. But we at least know which one takes precedence, if it wasn't obvious to begin with.
Alrighty. Thank you, Nathan. We did get a preview for Counterattack. Looks good. Looks pretty much more of the same. We know that they're trying to escape the prison, and we're going to get some more close-quarter fights and add another Jedi to the mix. So, well, should be interesting. We'll see if we lose an arc along the way.
I'm excited for next week. I really like this episode. Looks like next episode of Tarkin, Jet Master Peel, and it's going to be fun to see him actually get to fight in a full-blown maybe battle or something like that, as opposed to just in a hallway. So I'm looking forward to it. It'll be exciting.
It looks like an interesting episode. I'm sitting here wondering, though, why 2 weeks? Like, what did I miss that would require this to be 2 weeks of a gap instead of just 1 week, especially since this is the middle of a trilogy of episodes? I mean, if they were going to take a week off, why not this Friday? What am I missing that justifies that week off? Unless there's something in this episode being aired this week that somehow we need to remember to understand the last two parts of this trilogy. Otherwise, it really doesn't make sense. Either put it before these three, or put it after these three before the two-part finale, which is another whole ball of wax, because here we are with a three-part story and a three-part story, then the finale is only two. I don't think they'd be using the end of the season as a big three-part story, unless they're going to make it first two parts there, and then the third part being when we come back for season four.
One wonders if our season finale is the first half of an arc, and we actually have to come back the beginning of the next season to find out what happens.
I kind of wish I hadn't seen the preview, because that's something that I think would have been really exciting to just have pop up on the screen. Same with Captain Tarkin, actually. I kind of wish they hadn't spoiled that in the previews, but it doesn't bother me. I'm glad it's Chewie and not... I was afraid they were going to have, like, teenage Han or something, and that would have made me sad pan. So I can deal with Chewie. I'm interested to see how they handle him in the full episode. I feel like the previews are always a little misleading, so I'm never sure if what we see there has been portrayed correctly, because some of the stuff they put through a little bit misleading. But I like it. I think I can dig it. We'll see how we actually see the episode, though.
Well, I am excited, because if Chewbacca is showing up in the Clone Wars, Solo can't be far behind, because they go together like peas and carrots.
And they do have the concept art of young Han from when they were doing Revenge of the Sith. I kind of hope he doesn't show up, because of all the craziness continuity-wise that would ensue. Unlike with Chewie, which is a little bit easier to deal with, but, you know, the concept art was there, and they sure do like dipping back into that stuff.
We've got Greedo, now we're getting Chewbacca. I don't see how we're not going to get Solo, and I don't see the issue with that. I think that, you know, I would love to see Solo facing up against young Boba, you know, in the Clone Wars or after or something like that. You know, that I would love to see that.
It'd be cool to see, but it would be another one of those steamrolling over what exists before. It would wind up invalidating probably a giant chunk of Anne Crispin's Han Solo trilogy. And maybe it does. Maybe that's what they plan to do. I mean, T-Canon, George Lucas's vision, takes precedence, as we've said plenty. But it does make me a little bit wary, because then we're not dealing with some oddball little character having things thrown into chaos. This would be, I think, the equivalent from a fandom standpoint, almost, of the way people reacted to what happened with the Mandalorians being changed. I could see Han appearing in the Clone Wars causing a huge row, to use a word I hardly ever use, a huge row in the fan community.
Oh, absolutely. I could see that, too, because one of the fundamental EU-based stories or just EU ideas that everybody as a Star Wars fan knows is that Han saved Chewie from slavery when Han was in the Imperial Academy. So to say that they meet at some point in the prequels, that would be a nuke that, wow, that would send shockwaves.
It'd be like dropping a moon on him. Oh, wait, did that?
Oh, wait.
Is it too soon? Too soon?
You know, even if they didn't show Han and Chewie meeting and they just had Han in an episode all his own, that still would kind of muck up the waters, I would think.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, they might be able to find a way to make it work. And, again, it's up to Lucasfilm and the books, folks. It's up to Leland Chee, and it's up to the EU writers at Del Rey and Dark Horse and so forth. They're the ones who have to figure out how to make something like that work. The Clone Wars team can take that direction if they want to. And it might make for perhaps a more fun backstory for Han than we've ever seen before. It's just the reaction in the fan community is relatively predictable. Not what side they necessarily fall down on, not the exact arguments, because we haven't seen such an episode. But if that were to happen, you could bet it's going to be another of those major, major divisive episodes. I've already seen people getting divided on the issue of Chewie being in the Clone Wars, and he's in freaking Revenge of the Sith.
Not long before we get Death Troopers in the Clone Wars.
All right, I want to thank
Jen, Nathan, and Baron for joining me tonight to talk about The Citadel. And we will see everybody back here in 2 weeks to talk about Counterattack.
See everybody in 2 weeks.
Woohoo, vacation week! See you, everybody.
See you next time.
Now, we did get a ton of voicemails this week, so I want to encourage everybody to check out the second part of our discussion of The Citadel, including your voicemails about both this episode and last week's episode, Ghosts of Mortis, and maybe a couple other surprises. So be sure to check that out, and we will see everyone in 2 weeks for Counterattack.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Barrent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademarked, Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a production of Venganza Media Incorporated, copyright 2011, all rights reserved.
I'm going to play it when we play it.
Except it doesn't make sense to play it when we play it.
No, I like it when he plays it when we play it, because then I get to...
Go get a snack.
And I'm sure that whole comment will be cut out.
Well, as long as you realize it, see, it doesn't hurt as bad, does it? Before we get started, has Dabid made all the toast that he wants?
That'll be the new code word for douchebag.
Tarkin. You're such a Tarkin.
Tarkin.
That didn't bother me so much, Nathan, because, you know, I was an 20 years ago and I'm an now.
edit.
That's exactly what I think every time I edit a show.
There's a
blaster
sound in there somewhere. And this for the duct tape bandit on the forums. Ahem. She's lost the will to live. Whoa, the will to live. She's lost the will to live, and now it's gone, gone, gone. Whoa, 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 ba-boom, 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 boom, boom. You're welcome.